From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Richard Lachandres, Washington Bureau Chief for TVA Nouvelle. Our moderator is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, David Rennie.
And here are the issues. The North Korean leader Kim Jong-un invited Donald Trump to meet face-to-face. The American president has accepted. Will it be history in the making or a made-for-TV show? In Washington, Donald Trump shocked his own party and allies abroad when he slapped import tariffs on foreign steel and aluminium, then promptly said that countries that do what he wants in trade talks may be exempted. In the latest populist earthquake to rock Europe, an election in Italy ended with an anti-establishment protest party in first place and a virulent anti-immigrant party second. And in California, the Trump administration sued the state's government, seeking to strike down laws that forbid local businesses and governments from cooperating with federal immigration raids. So, Laura and Risha, it's another incredibly busy news week in Washington, but really the story that has a chance of going down in the history books, perhaps, is this first ever meeting, if it takes place, between an American president and the leader of the world's most reclusive, most totalitarian Stalinist regime, North Korea. And this came out of a kind of clear blue sky. What happened?
It really is stunning that we're talking about this today. I don't think anyone would have predicted this even 24 hours ago. What happened was, we've seen North Korea over the last couple months sort of slowly inch its way toward a sense of openness that was on display during the Olympics, their conversations with the South Koreans. South Korea clearly would like to lower tensions on the peninsula and has encouraged this. And then yesterday we find out that Kim had invited Trump to a meeting. And even more surprising, Trump accepted. So they're planning to meet. He says it's not a negotiation, but they are planning on having a meeting to. Obviously, there's a lot of issues on the table, like economic sanctions, the North Korea's nuclear program. You know, the stunning part about this is that typically the way U.S. presidents would have handled this sort of situation or would be expected to handle is that a meeting with the president would be sort of an end of the game activity. You would have negotiations, you would come to some preliminary agreements, and then the presidential meeting would sort of be the carrot out there that if we make it down the road, you get this high-profile meeting. In this case, we're putting that at the front of the pack, and these two very outspoken, unconventional leaders are going to be in a room together, and who knows what will happen.
So, Risha, Laura makes the very good point that normally America would hold out the offer of a meeting with the president as a kind of major concession in return for North Korea meeting conditions. And, of course, one of the things that as soon as this was announced, we saw skeptical commentary from people who are not sure that this is going to work. The North Koreans have been trying to meet American presidents to sort of show how they're an equal to the Americans for years, back to Bill Clinton, through George Bush, through Barack Obama. And although there were talks and there were deals done and promises made and then promises broken, to date, no American president felt that the conditions were there to meet the North Korean leader, although Bill Clinton, I think, came pretty close, but he finally decided he was going to do Middle East peace at the end of his term. But why does the White House think that now is different and now it's a good idea to do this right up front?
The way we understand it is President Trump has decided it was the right moment. We only have to look at where is diplomat en chef, is Secretary of State in Djibouti. He was totally out of the game. We had the Deputy Secretary.
Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, just didn't know this was going to happen.
He didn't even know that this is what was going to happen. And as Laura said, we didn't even know that Chung Un-yong, the South Korean National Security Advisor, was in town. And the president just shows up for a few seconds in the briefing room and says a major announcement will happen during the evening from the South Korean. So it looks like the president himself figured out that things were happening. Indeed, during the last months, at the beginning of the year, you remember, David, that in Pyongyang, Kim Jong-un himself said that he felt he had reached the level of nuclear development he was aiming for. So already there was a hint there. And then we've seen this Olympic opening with North Korean athletes joining South Korean athletes, and finally these discussions in Pyongyang with South Korean representatives, there was something happening. But reaching that point where mm-hmm. something happens with the United States has to be, it sounds, it looks like a one-man decision.
Richard makes a very good point, Laura. So, you know, it is true that actually before we all get very, very excited, you know, North Korea has a habit of it is very aggressive, very provocative. And then when it needs to buy time, it starts sending athletes to the Olympics. They have had summits with South Korean leaders twice before. And then they go back to provocation. You know, they blow hot and cold, and they're kind of masters at this. But Richard makes the point that maybe now what's new is that Kim thinks he has the nuclear weapons he needs to kind of come to the table as an equal. Does that make everyone in the administration, in the White House where you work, confident that this is definitely a safe moment and that Trump is the guy to handle this? Or is there a debate within the administration about whether this is a North Korea that you can negotiate with? And is there a debate in Washington about whether Trump is the man to do that negotiation?
Well, I think there's certainly a debate about this. I mean, I don't think there's any, you know, clear answers at all. And I don't know that there would be clear answers even in a more conventional American presidency. You know, there are not obvious answers of how to handle something like this. Like you said, Bill Clinton struggled with the decision himself. And but yes, I think the fact that he is doing this up front, I've heard people say it's crazy. I've also heard people, including Democrats, say it's bold and that let's see what happens. You know, it's sort of interesting to me thinking back when, you know, when Barack Obama was running for president and he said he would meet with the leaders of rogue states, including North Korea. He got incredible pushback for that. He was called naive, you know, didn't understand the world affairs. And yet here we have it actually happening. He, of course, never actually did that and ended up proceeding much more cautiously. You can say a lot of things about Donald Trump. I don't think cautious is the first one that would come to mind. So, yes, there is a debate. People aren't sure what to think of it. But unlike a lot of what he does, where a lot of people are just sort of think it's crazy and terrible, this, I feel like, is a little more mixed. Some people are saying, you know what, nothing else has worked. Let's see. But it is enormously risky. This is a guy who he's been taunting on Twitter, who he's been, you know, beating the war drums over. And if he goes there and he ends up getting essentially used and that's how it is perceived, I think that's really embarrassing for him. And then who knows what comes after.
And let's dig into what it would involve if he were to get played. So we know that the North Koreans are saying that they are willing to consider denuclearization if they have security guarantees. Now, if you speak to people who have negotiated with the North Koreans, their skepticism sometimes is, well, the problem is that we know what North Korea means when they say they want security guarantees. In previous go-arounds, they've then said, OK, that means every American soldier leaves South Korea. America breaks its treaty alliance with South Korea, breaks its treaty alliance with Japan. And then if you do all of that, we consider removing our nuclear weapons. So that has always been a massive kind of stumbling block. Is there a sense that Donald Trump is capable of kind of following them down that kind of an unconventional path? Or what are the sort of scenarios that might worry people?
David, your guess is just as good as mine. The way we see this and the discussions we have with experts on the topic, they underline the fact that for Kim Jong-un, his military might is the ultimate way to preserve his regime. There is no way abandoning this with just paper guarantees that nobody else will threaten him will suffice. The requests coming from the North, the soldiers, the American soldiers leaving the area, the entire peninsula being not only denuclearized but demilitarized, seems to be such a big outcome that discussing this in the next 2 months and a half and reaching some sort of clear, conscious agreement seems inconceivable. I wonder, and I would end my point on this, it is definitely an opportunity out of the alternative was the war, but people I've talked during the last 12 hours talked to came up with the word trap more often than opportunity in this mm-hmm. case.
And Laura, just one last point before we move on. Obviously, one of the odd things about the president is he is a conservative, he is a Republican, you know, in some ways. But if it came to being willing to remove troops, he doesn't always kind of take the traditional Republican line that American forces overseas is a source of American strength and power. Is that one of the kind of oddities as we go into this?
I suppose. But the idea that he would agree to pull American troops from the peninsula, I think, is a stretch. I mean, I guess it's possible. So
he has
sure.
threatened to the South Koreans in trade talks.
Well, so, he's threatened to pull, you know, immigration officers out of California, as we'll be discussing later. I mean, he makes a lot of threats, you know. I don't know that the Pentagon would let him agree to that, frankly.
So just before we go into the break, let's just tee up the next thing that we need to talk about, which was going to be the big news of the week before North Korea, which was tariffs, because we're starting what at least at one point looked like it might be a trade war. Now it looks more like a kind of trade skirmish or trade blackmail, but certainly some very unconventional tools and weapons being used by the American president. Risha, just as we head into the break, what do we know so far about what Donald Trump has done?
So he confirmed finally that using Section 232 in the Department of Commerce, which allows new tariffs as a national security reaction, well, he used that section to impose those tariff 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum, on allies, but then suddenly he backtrack, at least for Canada and Mexico, maybe Australia, we'll see. So what's interesting in all this is that the tariffs themselves came out of nowhere 10 days ago, and now they are confirmed, they're imposed. He signed two proclamations. They will happen in 15 days. And at the moment, everybody is kind of unhappy with the outcome.
Well, we will definitely come back to that, particularly as, Risha, you're from Canada, which is one of the countries right in the kind of crucible of this steel cauldron.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Richard London-Dress, Washington Bureau Chief for TVA Nouvelle. Our moderator is David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist.
So, Laura, let's just pick up where Richard was pointing out that Donald Trump, when he imposed these tariffs on foreign steel and foreign aluminium coming into America, he used a very unusual, very old piece of trade law, which was kind of an emergency button that a government is allowed to press if it believes that foreign imports damage its own ability to defend itself. Did he then muddy the sort of waters still further? Because having said that he had no choice but to use national security reasons to block sort of steel and aluminium, and talked about in his signing ceremony that American warships need to be built from American steel and American fighter planes need to be built from American sort of aluminium and all of these things, he then immediately announced that actually if you're nice to him in other trade disputes, you can get out of this. Yeah. So it isn't actually about national security. It's about whether you're nice to him in other trade disputes.
Well,
what's going on?
Well, what it really is about is his campaign, where he spoke directly to steelworkers, to manufacturing, and said he was going to support them and have their back and help these industries come back. And he is, you know, say what you want about him, he pays attention to the promises that he made as a candidate, and he's trying to fulfill them, whether they were good promises or not. So the problem he has is that how do you do that? How do you actually make good on that? So he's, you know, found this loophole. But as you say, it's once he started to actually talk about imposing these tariffs, there was such an outcry from many in his own party, as well as from our closest allies, that then he had to find a way to backtrack. So this is how he did. And he's gotten himself into this incredible pickle around this thing that, you know, I don't know that this would hold water at the World Trade Organization.
Well, unfortunately, he's used the magic button that he doesn't get a WTO challenge. But I think the fear is
is it a legitimate challenge at the end of the day? Is it legitimate?
It's a totally illegitimate
use of a
very effective magic button.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So I don't know whether then the problem becomes, now that he's done this and he's kind of undercut his own rationale, what he's really doing at this point now is he said, okay, well, this is now a tool where he can go around and say to anybody who wants to export steel to this country, you know, well, what we want from you is this, or we want from you is that. What we want from Canada and Mexico is this redrawn NAFTA agreement. Can I just add one other point, which is that the problems that he faced on this are beyond just our relationships with these other countries, in terms of them being annoyed and feeling like there's it's not sensical to use this magic button, as you say. But it's also they could impose their own tariffs back against us, which is how you end up with a trade war. And even if they don't, you have a lot of other American businesses that use steel and aluminum who are saying, you know, their prices are going to go up, so that you're helping one industry but hurting other industries. So this is a very complex set of policy and diplomatic issues. You push on one piece and it pops up somewhere else. So I think it's a lot more complicated than he bargained for when he started down this road.
Richard, tell us, you know, you're from Canada, which apparently it's suddenly a massive national security threat to have the dangerous rogue regime of Canada supplying steel and aluminium.
Have you seen their curlers?
Yes.
Steel and aluminium to the United States. And also, Canada clearly is in the throes of a very tense trade negotiation over the North American Free Trade Agreement. How has Canada taken Donald Trump kind of threatening tariffs and then saying, actually, Canada, not for the moment, you can be spared these tariffs if you do what I want? Is that going down well or badly in Canada?
It's not going very well. It's not going down very well, simply because already the negotiation, the renegotiations of NAFTA are far more complicated than whatever was expected at first. There are definitely commercial deficits. The Americans have one, a major one with Mexico, but with Canada, it's not even clear. The $15 billion seen from different perspective might be in favor of the U.S. So already negotiating NAFTA was not an easy thing to do for the Canadians themselves. Still, there was the foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland, who said a deal is within reach on NAFTA. But each time she comes out of the negotiation round, she's kind of not that enthusiastic, not that optimistic. And then suddenly, that was a reaction, and I'm just quoting her, Canada to be considered as posing any kind of security threat to the United States is inconceivable. I mean, the Canadians simply just can't follow the president and his logic when he comes up with this idea. In the end, it's blackmailing the Canadians with the tariffs into negotiating an accord and an agreement that will fit the president's expectations.
And will that work, or actually politically it's difficult for the Canadian government to give in to that kind of blackmail? Or are the interests so gigantic that Canadians will reluctantly
especially
give in?
On steel and aluminium, I don't see any way for the Canadians to ban on this. There are major industries. Aluminium in Quebec in particular is extremely important, major exporters to the U.S. Steel in the rest of Canada. It's been working very well for so many years, just like as for the way NAFTA is working, everything is interconnected, intertwined, and the Canadian and the Quebec factories are integrated into the North American way of having steel and aluminum and everything we produce. So it doesn't look like there's any way on this point Canada would make any concessions.
And very briefly, Laura, using your knowledge of kind of Washington politics, Republicans, until Donald Trump came along, used to be pretty much the party of free trade, at least Republicans in Congress. And you have had some leading figures in Congress saying very cross things about this. Are they going to defy their president? Are they going to stop him doing what he wants? Or has he basically got the Republican Party kind of, you know, rolling on their backs?
The Republicans are very upset about this. I mean, you've seen more pushback, I think it's fair to say, from the Republican Party on this action than anything else that's happened in the Trump presidency, which is pretty remarkable because he's done some very provocative things in other areas as well. But this is the thing that has upset more people. You've had Mitch McConnell, the head of the Senate, and the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, both personally come out and speak negatively about this. So there is a tremendous amount of pushback.
So let's turn to Europe. And another election in which populists have really shaken things up in a very dramatic way. Now, Italy is not always a country with stable politics. It's had some fairly unusual politicians before. But this time, Richard, we have had a general election in Italy where more than half the vote went to basically extreme parties, slightly different sorts of extreme. One, a very right-wing anti-immigrant party. One, a sort of anti-establishment, sort of left-wing, spend lots of money, kind of paranoid kind of protest party. What happens next?
How do you build a government out of this? Already in Italy, it's never simple. But in this very case, and also because they've redone their own system of representation, so it's already not very easy. A coalition needs around 40% of the vote. And in this very case, no movement or party has reached this. But still, the fact that, as you were saying, you were talking about the anti-establishment party, the five-star movement, it's been extremely popular. One-third of the vote, 32.6% of the electorate, went for this party, which is, I mean, now talks like it's ready to get into governing Italy, but in the past, it was out of question that it was a party that wanted to get to power. As for La Ligue, La Liga, the former Northern League, which is a secessionist party in Northern Italy, mm-hmm. a strongly anti-immigration with Forza Italia, Silvio Berlusconi party, in a center-right coalition. Well, this at the moment, this La Liga, the League, with a strong score, is in good position of requesting the right to form the government. So now we're in a situation where, as crazy as it would have appeared before, this anti-immigration extreme or very strongly right party of the League and the anti-establishment all over the place five-star movement could be discussing some form of a government. What is obviously an outcome of this is that the left is struggling to renew itself. Matteo Renzi with the Democratic Party
The
former Prime Minister has done a horrible job in trying to appeal to the electorate. And as for on the right side, the traditional party, if we can look at Forza Italia's center-right and in mm-hmm. a party. I mean, Silvio Berlusconi, he has been Prime Minister. He knows how to manage a state. He has done a horrible score himself. So the traditional party are going nowhere there, like we notice in France and we notice in some other places.
And once again, just to wrap up Italy, the one country that's probably very happy is Russia, because the two extreme populist parties that have won are both very pro-Russian and quite suspicious of Western alliances. So another win for Vladimir Putin without even trying. Laura, let's turn to California before we close. A giant state, 23 million people, very democratic state on the whole, but has been defying the Trump administration over immigration rules. And now we have the Trump administration's top law officer traveling to California and saying that he's going to sue the state government. What's been going on?
Well, and actually filing suit. The federal government is suing the state of California. This, to me, is sort of a heavyweight cage match that has been building for more than a year since Trump took office. California and the Jeff Sessions at the Justice Department have both been sort of spoiling for a fight over immigration. Donald Trump has come in with a much more heavy enforcement agenda on immigration, saying that they're not going to turn their backs when they see people who are living in the country illegally. They are going to move them towards deportation, a much broader sense of who is subject to deportation than we had in the under the Obama administration. And California has pushed back and has passed a series of laws that are meant to serve as protections of sorts for undocumented people living in their state. Now you have Jeff Sessions filing suit on behalf of the United States against California, saying that basically, California, you can't write your own immigration law. This is a federal matter. You're getting in our way.
Because let's be clear, some of these laws, even if you think that immigration policy shouldn't be as strict as Jeff Sessions, I mean, I think one of the laws says that business owners, if they know that there's going to be an immigration raid, they have to warn their employees so they can run away and hide before the immigration authorities get there. I mean, that's kind of out there, no?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, it is. It is.
And
it
they're legally obliged to tell
them.
Right,
so you have businesses essentially, although there is a loophole in there for, you know, they don't do anything that's counter to federal law. But yes, businesses are, and also law enforcement in California are both caught in between, and essentially some of them would like to cooperate with federal enforcement, and then they're being told by the state, if you do, you'll be running afoul of state law. So I think that this has put them in a difficult position.
And is the bottom line that this is a legal fight that both sides actually think will help them politically?
100%.
And potentially the losers are the immigrants hiding in the shadows.
While
the politicians fight.
California is sticking up for them, so we'll see if they're the losers or not.
Well, that's all the time we have. And thanks to Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Richard Atendresse, Washington bureau chief for TVA Nouvelle. This programme is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm David Rennie of The Economist. Thanks for listening.